If you're listening to this, there's a good chance you work within the real estate investing industry. There's another good chance that you would like to increase the sales of your products or services.
Well, you're in the right place.
United States Real Estate Investor is a platform you need to place your brand directly in front of your target audience. With our focused, growing audience of real estate investing beginners, enthusiasts, and seasoned professionals, you can continually reach our captivated viewers and listeners with ease. To learn more or to get started today, just visit UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com/advertising. That's UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com/advertising. Get ready to increase your brand awareness and your bottom line. Attract clients with content.
Excuse me, caught me off guard there, guys. Welcome to this month in real estate investing. In this episode, we'll be covering a variety of news items related to real estate investing, including, here's our top three, turning a tiny fraction of America's dead strip malls into housing could create 700,000 new apartments. Middle class movers are heading to these three cities in search of affordability. And San Francisco landlords challenge a new law that taxes them for not renting their units. All this and more on this episode of This Month in Real Estate Investing. Let's start the show. All right, guys, I'm your host, James Brown, and I show people how to make safe double-digit returns through our hybrid investing model. Go to hybridinvestor.vip to learn more. If you're watching live, feel free to comment and ask questions. We'll see those questions, and we can jump in there and answer and create a dialogue. Our guests today are Jennifer Statz. Hopefully I'm saying that right. Kevin Amalsh and Beth Underhill. So in that order, guys, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourselves, share your background, what types of investing you focus on, and we'll jump into the news after that.
Awesome. Hey, everybody, and thanks for having me. My name is Jennifer Statz. I'm an owner of Statz Solutions, which is an operations management company for real estate businesses. So we manage the operations of about 20 different companies nationwide right now, real estate brokerages, teams, commercial, investment, all you name it, we manage it.
Awesome. Thank you. Go ahead, Kevin.
You want me to go next? My name is Kevin Amalsh. I'm the founder of Pine Financial Group. It's a private money lender based in Colorado. We do quite a bit of business in Minnesota as well. So we have several mortgage funds and we use that to make loans to real estate developers and real estate fix and flippers.
Fantastic. Go for it, Beth.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Beth Underhill. I'm the owner and CEO of Lifestyle Equities Group based in Cincinnati, Ohio. I buy multifamily student housing, hotel, and hotel conversions, actually. I'm also the CMO of MTN Investment Group, where I handle all the marketing and investor relations, as well as compliance. Happy to be here today. Thank you.
Awesome. It's going to be a good group. Love it. All right. Thanks for being here. Let's dive into the news. So the first news item up from United States Real Estate Investor, WeWork stock plummets near edge of bankruptcy. This has been in the news for a while. I'll just kind of kick off from the article. Looks like they're facing Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And according to stock data, they're down 37%. So they're failing to meet even their interest payments. So it's not looking good. Anybody have any comments on that or know anything about WeWork?
I don't think anybody should be surprised, right? I mean, gosh, millennials especially, but people don't want to go to the office anymore. Everybody wants to work from home. So to have a company that's highly focused on office, that's kind of a recipe for disaster, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, coming from my company is 100% virtual, and we used to rent space like that. And I feel like COVID hit and we had no use for it anymore because it made way more sense for all my staff to be at home. So it allowed us to be nationwide and not have an office space.
Yep. So you're just doing everything on Zoom and phone calls, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. I personally, I've always worked out of my home. So going to an office for me was like, no way, you know, don't want to do it. I kind of ditched the whole corporate world a long time ago, but you know, it takes obviously a certain discipline to work out of your house, not go kind of have that routine and so forth. But yeah, I mean, with COVID, it's been hard to get people back. I have friends who were, you know, kind of being told they have to come back one or two days out of the week and whatnot. And they've struggled with that. So, you know, certainly not surprised to see that this business model just has not worked out.
You know, James, what I'd be very curious about when I look at this article here is what's the impact to the landlord? I mean, gosh, you have, I'm looking at it right now, in 2023, WeWork leased 7 million square feet of space in New York alone. Like, what is going to happen to these landlords?
They're hosed. Technical term.
Good opportunity, so possibly.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see.
And I think since this article has come out, haven't they officially filed? I believe they have filed bankruptcy.
I believe so, too.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah, which is, again, very unfortunate and going to be left with a lot of office space to do something with. And conversions seem to be, you know, the hot ticket right now, converting them into other things and primarily places for people to live. So,
yeah. Yeah. And as we know, there's a shortage of places to live. So we'll talk about that. We always talk about that in on this show. At least one news article comes up. So let's jump into the next one from Wealth Management. New generation of capital providers is helping syndicators weather today's storm. Are any of you guys actually syndicating deals?
I am.
Yes, you are.
I am. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. As we know, a lot of these syndicators are in trouble with their existing properties because they're over leveraging and they've got these floating rate debts with balloons that 5 to 7 years typically, right? So they end up having to face high rates. So
yeah, I'd be very curious, Beth, what you're seeing out there. I'm LP in 5 different syndications, and all 5 stop distributions, and 2 of them had capital calls.
Ooh.
And it's all because of these interest rate caps. So, yeah, tell me, what are you seeing? How are your investors reacting? And I didn't see this news article, but curious, where is the money coming to save these deals?
Sure. So, I'll take a few for instances. We've closed on 2 deals within the last year, and both of them we actually had assumable loans, 3.62%, 4.38%. So very lucky with respect to that. But we did have actual private equity come in, joint venture partners, which made our raising for our retail capital, you know, much easier because we did not have to raise as much. So very thankful for that. We're in the midst of actually a deal in which we had the senior debt lined up and then we had a mezz piece, but the senior loan, the senior debt and then the mezz, they could not communicate. They could not get on the same page with respect to legal language. So it sort of imploded on us, and we had to pivot and go to some short-term financing in which we are buying a rate cap to keep that number down for a bit, which of course then makes it, you know, a little bit more challenging in terms of raising the retail capital, because now we have a bigger tranche that we actually have to raise. But yeah, I've been involved in a capital call, not me myself, but in deals in which there was a capital call. The money didn't come in from the investors. The investors were very upset, not happy about it. And the GP ended up having to, you know, foot the bill and cover what they needed to cover. What wasn't, of course, raised by that capital call. So it's some interesting times out there. And that's why you have to be super conservative in terms of your underwriting and the deals that you're actually going after. And again, very, very blessed to be able to be involved in a couple of deals in which we were able to assume those nice low rates for a number of years. And we actually, one property in particular, we've been distributing ever since the first quarter after taking that property over. So pretty lucky there.
So on the assumables, I mean, commercial debt, I think that's something we're going to talk about, James, is the problems in the commercial debt industry. They're all term. They're all short-term loans, right? They might amortize 25 years, but they're five-year term, seven-year term. So what happened when you underwrite your deals? Are you stress testing at the higher rates?
Because absolutely. Absolutely. And we actually, our underwriter, he comes from an institutional background. So he, so his underwriting is, you know, take conservative and go at least one or two steps further. And he's just ultra conservative because he's so used to underwriting from that perspective. And so, yes, I mean, now some of these rates that we've assumed, I mean, we still have seven years on one of them. So, you know, and we're buying Class A assets. So these Class A assets, they're newer developments. The developers, you know, got it leased up, maybe just hasn't, you know, really pushed rents to where they need to be. You know, they're locked in for, you know, 10 years when rates were really low. So we're coming in at a really opportune time to be able to kind of ride out this storm, so to speak, and see where we are 10 years from now, in which we may not even own the asset by then. Who knows?
Yep. So we've got a fund of funds. We just actually closed out a deal in Kansas City, 200 unit townhome complex. And it was, we've taken over a 3.9% interest rate. Great. It's got another 3 years on it. And we may or may not sell it. You know, we may have to hold it depending on where rates are, but we definitely did, like you said, Beth, back tested it at 10%, you know, just make sure if we end up with that, it's still going to work. So we're excited. It's our first fund of funds that we've done, partnering with Aspen Funds, if you're familiar with them. Mm-hmm. But kind of a new venture for us and for our investors, you know, partnering with GPs. Because mainly what we do is we're in single family, doing lease options, rent to own. So just giving our investors some different options, but it's super important to partner with GPs, general partnerships, for people that don't know this whole syndication model. The operators, the people that go find apartment buildings as an example, or self-storage, they've got a track record in that space. So they find the deals, run the numbers, do any value add, which is pretty typical, you know, doing remodels on units and then holding it, managing it, ideally selling in a certain time period or holding it. So just a little education for people that aren't familiar with that strategy. So.
Well, and you said something really important, James. If someone is considering investing in a syndication, it's very important to look at the track record of the general partnership and what they've done full cycle. A lot of times it's, you know, bright, shiny object syndrome, where you're looking just at the numbers of a deal and you're not necessarily looking at the operators. And the numbers may look great. Anybody can make numbers look great, right? But it's also like, what have the operators done? What have they, you know, been able to do with previous properties and so forth? I see a lot on, you know, Facebook, for instance, LinkedIn and so forth, operators who are newer to the space, and they are, you know, hey, we closed on this and hey, we closed on that. And I'm like, hey, you know, kudos, like, congratulations. You know, I hope that, you know, your investors are going to be okay. Not that I'm doubting them, but those investors are, you're possibly getting into something because they see the numbers and they don't actually know anything about the operators. So.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, end up in situations like Kevin was talking about. They stop distributions, and then all of a sudden there's capital calls. They got to come up with more money to keep it going. That's not a good situation. So, yeah. All right. Any other comments before we jump to the next one? Okay. From Business Insider. Turning a tiny fraction of America's dead strip malls into housing could create 700,000 new apartments. We could use those 700,000. It says 10% of these malls could yield the 700,000. So I guess there's, let's see, 947 million square feet of strip mall space that's empty. So there's some opportunity there.
Absolutely. Also,
yeah, it said creates walkable mixed use neighborhoods right off the bat because they're right there. Somebody was going to say something.
Yeah, I just said we really need, I mean, everywhere that we service is really, really struggling with inventory, even because of the market. So I definitely think that this could be a good opportunity to turn some of that into some, you know, affordable, you know, places to live for people.
Yeah. It did say there. We've talked about this on the show too, with options like this, zoning regulations, that's can be a problem. In this article, it says community support, complex financing, and then just the logistics, like, okay, we've got retail space. Now we need livable space that has different plumbing and electrical, and, you know, adding multiple bathrooms. That's probably the biggest challenge. Like, how do you convert this building that's already designed for, you know, whatever?
Yeah, James, I think this is so awkward. Like, and I hear this with the office conversions too. You're starting to see that. How do you convert? If you think about an office building, or in the malls even, you know, magnifies this, but if you think about an office space and it's a big open room with windows around the edge, right? Well, how do you turn that into apartments? Because apartments need windows. You can't, I mean, the center of the office is useless in that case. And the mall's even bigger than that. So how do you convert, take the plumbing out? How do you even convert it and have like access to the units? We're seeing, we're working on our second one now. We're seeing conversions in malls for sure, but not to living space. We're seeing self-storage. We're seeing entertainment districts. We're seeing smaller use retail some, but it's not housing. Like, help me understand that.
Right. I can't help.
And you know, another issue, I mean, it's interesting, the article, but what we've seen is the municipalities are so like behind. They want that retail mall in their city, right? They don't want it to be a different use. So getting them to see that this isn't working, we got to turn this into some income for the city, for us, for everybody. We're seeing that it's a challenge at the city level.
Yeah.
It, you know, we're working on a hotel conversion in Kissimmee, and, taking this hotel, and obviously a hotel, it's more natural in terms of converting it into living space because you do have windows, and generally speaking, obviously with hotels, I mean, there's some in some hotels in which maybe there's not, but generally speaking, yes. And you know, just what we've had to jump through, we've actually been working on this. It'll be, I think, 2 years coming up in February. Wow. So that's a very long time, a lot of hoops to jump through. And, you know, even though, you know, a city, municipality, you know, they may want that housing, they certainly don't make it easy to get to, you know, the point where you can actually move forward with it. So, the red tape will always play a role, of course. It'd be interesting to see what happens with some of these shopping centers, malls, and so forth. I know someone who works for Macy's, and he goes around the country, you know, looking at all of their Macy's locations and if they should, you know, still continue to stay in business or, you know, as the anchor for, you know, a mall, should they, you know, consider converting that to something else. And apparently the way, you know, some of it was structured when they first came into some of these malls, they have the ability to do so. They just need everybody else on board, you know, within the mall to actually, you know, give the okay to. So, very, very fascinating to see what will happen with some of these spaces as we continue to see, you know, the retail outlets, although, you know, they're smaller retail, you know, seems to be doing better, you know, so than some of the larger retail right now. So we'll see.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of conversions from hotels. That makes perfect sense to me. I mean, you have access to the units. You can't have a unit without a window. That's a fire code. I'm sure of it. But, the conversions for, like we're talking about the malls, but also office, I mean, I don't see them penciling. I've looked at several and it's just too expensive to convert it. It's cheaper to tear it down and build.
Yeah. It's too bad. It's crazy when they have to scrape, but that's the reality, right? All right. Well, hey, let's jump to the next one from The Verge. Google scraps $15 billion deal with lead developer of Silicon Valley campus projects. I guess they had four major campus projects in Silicon Valley, trying to make it work since 2019 to redevelop these. I don't know the details. It didn't dive into that, but anybody have any comments on that?
Well, it looks like it's brand new development, right? That's the way I read that. I'm curious on why, but it's got to be building costs, right?
Yeah. I would think so. Well, it does say the deal initiated in 2019 was set to redevelop Google's land. So, man, I don't know. I know one of our other... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it was a combination of a few different things, including the fact that, you know, Google had some layoffs and, you know, not bringing everybody back into, the office space. So there wasn't like use for actually developing and moving forward with the project. That's the way I understood it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Out of any company that's tech based, I could see them being the most set up to do remote and not use office space.
Yeah.
So, all right, cool. Well, let's take a break to learn from one of our sponsors.
Hey, it's me, Antonio Holman, founder of United States Real Estate Investor and producer of This Month in Real Estate Investing. Are you ready to ignite your financial freedom with what has been called the hottest REI strategy around, or should I say strategies? Enter Jason Palliser's 2-day investment blueprint, where you will learn the secrets that the real estate investing community doesn't know because they never had a reason to before. With Jason's 2-day investment blueprint, you will learn how to tackle real estate deals with over 40 different strategies, which means your chances of losing another deal nearly disappears completely. In Jason's 2-day life transformation intensive, you will learn how to generate more deals, close deals faster, win more deals over other investors, multiply your real estate deal strategies, and much more. Jason's 2-day investment blueprint can help you grow your REI business to 6 and 7 figures faster with much less aggravation. If you want to learn how to invest in any market in the United States, even the tough markets, and close multiple deals per month, visit 2dayblueprint.com. That's the number 2dayblueprint.com. And make sure you tell them you heard it here on This Month in Real Estate Investing. Don't believe the no more good deals hype and visit 2dayblueprint.com today. Now back to James with This Month in Real Estate Investing.
All right, from Bloomberg via Yahoo Finance, Capital One seeks to offload more New York City commercial property loans. So they've got, they're seeking bids for $200 million in debts, $120 million of them, of that is non-performing, looks like five office buildings, and then $71 million of that is nine actually performing loans in Manhattan, mostly retail and apartment spaces, looks like. So who wants a deal? Anybody? Anybody?
Yeah, I mean, is the storm coming? I mean, you're going to offload performing notes. That's the only reason you would do that, James, at a discount, is because you're anticipating them not to perform.
Yeah.
Right. So the assets are coming due in the next year or two. So the chances of them being able to modify or refinance those is pretty much zero.
Yeah.
The debt service coverage ratios, we all know it. 1.2, 1.25. That's what banks need. It's regulated, right? And at the higher interest rate, two or three times what they're locked in at. You guys are telling me you're assuming loans at 3%. You're going to be north of 6 right now, even for, like, you know, conventional and mortgage-backed security debt, commercial mortgage-backed security debt, you're two times. So how does that debt service coverage ratio work? It makes total sense that they're selling it. I think there's a bigger issue here, honestly. I think banks are in trouble. And there was a recent study that there's 186 banks, like, basically on the watch list. The risk of failure is high. And the reason for that is because their non-insured deposits are too high. And if there's going to be a run on the bank, it's those, right? It's the people that don't have the FDIC insurance on their deposits. That's where the withdrawals will come from. And if there's a run and you don't have liquidity to pay those withdrawals, you're screwed. Mm. So I'm curious on the mortgage, the commercial mortgages, how that is going to impact the commercial banks in the next, say, 2 years.
It's going to be bumpy, isn't it? And interesting.
I mean, scary. You're telling me you're going to offload a performing note at a discount? I mean, they need liquidity, right? That's scary.
Yeah. Yeah. What are commercial loans at? I don't really know that side of it.
I mean, I'm in the private debt side, right? So I don't follow that either. But commercial mortgage backed securities, that's. You guys are borrowing that stuff, right? Conventional?
Yeah, well, yes. Debt. I mean, obviously our short-term debt, right? Our short-term loan on this one particular project is definitely higher, but, you know, we've had verbal commitments from Deutsche Bank, for instance, to come in when we're able to actually refinance, and they're in the sixes somewhere. So that's probably what we'd be looking at.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Interesting. Well,
what do you think, James?
I don't know. I don't have any comment.
You know, the smaller commercial banks, I mean, this is a big one, right? Capital One's huge. But if you're looking at your smaller regional banks, they make up like 60% of all commercial debt. It's a big, big number. Am I the only one concerned here?
It's pretty scary.
Yeah,
I think obviously inflation and the federal policies and all of that, it's a concern, right? And we're feeling the effects of that. But what I think we're overlooking is a problem in the banking. I don't know that people are taking that serious. When banks start falling, that's 2008. Now, I'm not suggesting we're going there, right? I do not think that. Absolutely not. But I'm having a hard time understanding the soft landing when we have a crisis over here.
Yeah. I don't know.
I would agree with you. We have a couple of investors in particular that you know, they, when they're wiring funds into our syndications and so forth, they want to know, what bank are you using? And there was one instance in which we actually had to switch a bank. This investor was coming in with $800,000 and they're like, I do not want my bank in this particular bank. I need it to go in this bank if that's okay when you're going to hold my funds. And she was very adamant about it because she had been hearing through the grapevine, like, hey, something might be going down with that particular bank and I don't want my money sitting there. So I don't know. I don't know what she knows, but I sure would love to. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot to think about where it is that we will hold their funds because of some of these very same reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the statistics, so don't quote me on this one, but I think it's around 2%, the amount of insurance the FDIC has for all the insured deposits. So it's nowhere near enough to satisfy. So the banking, and there's so much non-insured deposits, right? So I think that's where you're going with this 800,000. That's well over the limit. So that would be non-insured at that point. And you think about Silicon Valley, I know that was back in March. If it wasn't for the government bailing the depositors out, which they're not supposed to do, by the way, we would have had a big issue. I mean, Roblox would have went out of business like overnight. Then what kind of like ripple effect does that have?
Yeah, I don't know. Again.
$500 million of non-insured deposit is what that one entity had.
Yeah, those are big numbers.
Mm-hmm. And then you have a bunch of people that lose their jobs and no income, and then they stop spending. And that's something I don't think we're going to get to here, James. What we might want to is the consumer spending. It's out of control. And the report that just came out like today about Friday, Black Friday's way up spending, and we're at record high consumer debt. Like, how is this even possible?
Yeah. It's been interesting.
30% interest rates on those credit cards, by the way.
What was it?
30% interest rates on some of these credit cards.
Ooh-wee.
Woohoo.
I need to get in that business. That's a good return.
Right?
What are we doing, guys? Let's start a credit card company. Holy smokes. All right. Hey, let's go to the next article from Benzinga. Boardrooms to bedrooms. Will big tech companies convert empty offices into employee housing? Jason Calcanis proposed that companies like Apple convert their vacant office buildings into residential housing for employees. I guess 30% of downtown San Francisco office space is sitting empty. Yikes.
Well, that's why you see hedge funds saying, here's the keys, right? They're not going to make payments on those loans anymore in San Francisco.
Yeah. That is a crazy market. I know like a friend of mine, he actually got a job with Google, moved out there, and he didn't end up buying in downtown San Francisco for years just because the costs there are so crazy. First, you know, single family.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept making offers on places and getting outbid, cash offers. A lot of Chinese investors just paying cash and getting beat out. So that's residential. So any other comments on this?
I mean, I think it's going to be the same thing as the hotels. Like, what's the expense of doing this? And does it make sense for an employer to do this type of conversion? It's going to depend, especially when a lot of people want to work from home anyways. So do they really want to live next door to the office?
Yeah.
In the office.
I wouldn't.
You just walk out and then you're like in the lobby.
Right.
Well, or I mean, if they're taking the actual, but if they're taking the actual office space and they're converting it to make it into the residential living so that, you know, their employees can just stay at home and they don't have to then wrestle with, you know, bringing them back quote unquote, into the office, which I think is, you know, it's this interesting dynamic that all companies are struggling with now. I think there's a benefit to having everyone in the same place at the same time. But, you know, clearly we've been able to show that we can operate not in an office and still have success and still be able to, you know, build camaraderie and teamwork and so forth. And so I think if they position it that way, where, hey, this is the alternative, instead of coming into the office, we're actually going to convert this office, make it your living space, and now you can just stay at home and work from here. That would be, to me, the way to go.
Yeah. Commuting in and out of San Francisco would be a pain in the butt, and it's a cool place to live. Well, there's a lot of issues with homeless and what is that? There's an app that tracks like poop.
Yeah.
from all the homeless. It's crazy. There's an app for that.
Yeah. We literally have a full-time employee at our commercial brokerage in San Francisco that goes out front and cleans up all of the feces every morning.
Human.
Yep.
Thanks.
Yep.
No, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's not a homeless problem. That's a government problem.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Or are we going to get into that? Yeah.
Sure. I think we're going to talk about later on about the which cities people are moving into because of taxes. Well,
right.
Why are they moving out of other cities?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Have you guys seen the like animated map of the flow out of like cities like San Francisco to Colorado to Midwest? Right. So it's pretty.
I think it's a great idea. I don't know how you implement it.
Yeah. It's every government's got some major challenges trying to figure it out. How to deal with it. Antonio says that's why tech billionaires are buying up their own land to create a new private city in Silicon Valley. Oh yeah, we talked about that. Yeah. Let's see where that goes. All right, let's jump to the next one from Business Insider. Middle class movers are heading to these three cities in search of affordability. So
there you go.
If you're wondering, Las Vegas, where Antonio's moving shortly, Phoenix, and San Antonio. I'll just kind of take some notes. So Vegas, reasons for moving there, abundance of homes for sale. You know, I know Vegas gets hit when there's downturns. So affordable homes there, absence of state income tax, like you were saying, Kevin. And let's see, Colorado, let's see. Oh yeah. Las Vegas. We were relating it to the new Colorado because that's where Kevin and I live. A lot of people moving here from California, mainly New York. So that lack of taxes, and we don't have high taxes, property taxes here compared to like in New York, but people come here for lower prices than California, lower taxes, the lifestyle, all that. Let's see, Phoenix, they've seen a lot of people moving from California. Also that, you know, affordability. San Antonio, just kind of general better value, of more affordable. So did I hog that news item? Anybody have anything to add?
I mean, this was literally me 6 years ago. I moved from LA to Colorado Springs, and it was just, you know, affordability. I sold my house. We were commuting 2 hours each way, went to Colorado Springs, have like zero commute, bought like triple the house, and it's amazing. So I can see that this is going to continue to happen. And there's a lot of things related, right? We're talking government, we're talking affordability, we're talking taxes, all that stuff. But there's a lot of, you know, benefits in changing where you're living, especially because everyone's working from home. It doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. For a lot of jobs. I forgot you were in the Springs. So yeah, all three of us from Colorado.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
I'm a Midwest gal. So
say that again.
I said I'm a Midwest gal.
Oh, yeah.
Texas is very unique in that it wants people there. So that's why you have no state income tax. Now the property taxes are extremely high. But if you're renting, which that's the new movement, right? It's more affordable. We're seeing it all over the news. It's more affordable to rent than to buy. And that's true in like over 90% of the major markets. So why wouldn't you go to a place with no income tax that wants you there, that's giving incentives to businesses to bring jobs, somewhere that's stable? I mean, it makes sense. I wouldn't want to live there. I love Colorado, but it makes sense.
Yep. Well, let's jump into the next one from Mansion Global. The average U.S. home buyer now needs a six-figure income. We've touched on this multiple other episodes. It says the increase, it's rising by 22% to 107,000 in June compared to 88,000 in 2022. That's a huge jump.
This is clickbait. This is total clickbait. Here's the thing that we understand as investors, professionals in real estate. This doesn't mean anything. Real estate is more micro than that. You're telling me an average across the entire United States? That's ridiculous. What am I supposed to do with this? Sorry.
Good question.
A little rant there.
Man, Kevin, you keep stumping.
It means nothing. We know it's not affordable. That's because inflation has been out of control, because the government spends too much money. This is all stuff we know.
That's why I love this show. let's cut through the BS, the clickbait, right?
It's just silly. I mean, you could find different markets that's more affordable, like Colorado Springs compared to California, right?
Yeah.
Compared to LA. That makes total sense. Yeah. I don't know. Sorry. I'll stop.
No, I love it. I love it. Let's see. Just looking at some notes here. It said down payments reached their highest levels. Some, you know, closer to like 19%. That's interesting, because there's a lot of first-time homebuyer programs where you get in with 3.5% down or even less with some.
But yeah, if you're competing, people paying all cash, does that count? What if my down payment's the entire purchase price?
Right. Yeah, like, you know, I was doing listings here in Colorado, like during the pandemic. We had cash buyers coming in. Boy, it's hard for one of my sellers to say no to a cash offer. And some of those cash offers are pseudo cash offers, right? Because there's companies, like ones that I work with, where they basically do a bridge loan, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty handy. I mean, that's the net result for that seller is it's still a cash offer. Mm-hmm. They don't have to worry about it. Quicker close, more guaranteed. They're willing to take a little bit less because of that versus a FHA loan, 3.5% down. They got regulations on, you know, the condition of the property, those kinds of things that make it worth taking a little bit lower for that cash offer. But it sucks for those first-time home buyers that their only option is that FHA loan with that low down. They're just going to get beat out. So,
you know what this tells me? That lenders are being smarter. I mean, if you look at the credit availability index, I don't know if you guys have ever looked at that, but it's mortgage bankers put this out, and they keep it pretty up to date. And it's a graph that shows you how available is mortgage credit, right? And it's like all-time lows right now. And the reason for that is because they're being so much smarter because of the pain that they went through in 2008, 9, mm-hmm. 10. So are they requiring, if it's not an FHA-backed insured loan, more down payment? Sure. And that's why it's going to keep us out of the great recession like we saw back then. We're not going to go into that. In fact, I don't know that we see property values, single family home property values decrease at all. And this is a big reason why we have record equity.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of equity in, well, that's here in Colorado. You know, we're trying to help distressed buyers, not finding them. They, if they had their their house for not too long. They had plenty of equity, where if they had to sell it, they had enough equity to pay out commissions and closing costs and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's a combination of the rapid increase in values and the higher down payment requirements.
Yep. Yeah. Any other comments on all that? Looking here. It says there is a rise in minority buyers, foreign-born buyers, and non-English speakers. I definitely see that, especially like, you know, I'm in the rent-to-own world, helping people that can't get qualified for loans. They're oftentimes those folks, they have cash businesses. They're not reporting enough of that cash that they're making to the detriment of being able to get a loan from a bank. And it's good. Like those banks have rules in place, so we don't end up in an 08, right? So that's the gap we fill, is helping those people get on that path to home ownership. So, well, let's take a break for our next sponsor.
It's me again, Antonio Holman, founder of United States Real Estate Investor and producer of This Month in Real Estate Investing. You know, one of the best ways to increase your company's brand awareness and increase warm leads is to create written content online. But as we know, content creation can be very time consuming and not very cost effective when having to pay professional copywriting fees. It's time to use REI Content Packs. REI Content Packs, done for you content packs, give you the tools, flexibility, and cost-effective way to increase your brand's visibility and online presence without spending hours or even days stressing on what to create. REI Content Packs are a collection of high-quality, ready-made real estate blog articles exclusively created for the real estate investing industry. Can you imagine the possibilities if you could do 2 to 3 more deals per month without increasing your ad spend? REI Content Packs can help you do that. Can you imagine getting unlimited online traffic, increasing your Google ranking, getting more leads, and making more money? REI Content Packs can help you do that too. To get started increasing your brand's content and lessening your workload, head on over to thismonthinrealestateinvesting.com/REI Content Packs. That's thismonthinrealestateinvesting.com/REI Content Packs. It's time to get off the online marketing hamster wheel. Try REI Content Packs today at thismonthinrealestateinvesting.com/REI Content Packs. Now back to James and This Month in Real Estate Investing.
Okay, from Benzinga, San Francisco landlords challenge a new law that taxes them for not renting their units. Kevin, you might have some comments on government oversight.
That's funny. I mean, it's clearly a property rights issue here. I'd be very curious where this goes. But look, I mean, what they're trying to prevent is the foreign investors, like you were just mentioning, money from China or wherever, where they just put the cash and just let the value go up, or the Airbnb stuff. I mean, I've got to assume that this targets those two. But this happened a couple of times in Colorado and in Denver, and developments that I've been a part of, and it, not this specifically, but when the government tries to overstep and take property rights away, and it usually doesn't end too well. So I don't see how they could get this to go through. I don't know. I don't love it. I understand it. It makes sense, but I don't love it because I'm an investor. I mean, I own properties. I want my rights as a property owner. I don't think the government should impede on that.
Yeah. And the thing, I'm like, why would you leave a place vacant at all?
It's stupid money, James. It's just stupid money. They have so much of it, they don't know where to put it, and they feel safer in American real estate than they do in other options.
Yeah. Well, there's those ghost cities in China that I guess they're starting to knock some of those buildings down. That it's the same thinking. I'm like, I don't understand. It was saying here, let's see, just for some details, anything vacant over 182 days annually, were the, and if they're 3 or more units, Those are the ones they were targeting. Hmm. So
how are they going to monitor that?
I was going to ask the same question. Yeah. How do you monitor that?
Good question.
Create a government department and have people pay them to watch it.
Because what if it's like owner occupied and you have like a second home elsewhere? Are you really going to give someone information on when you're home or not? That doesn't make any sense to me.
I suppose they could be monitoring on sites like Airbnb to see if properties are out there or if like units and so forth. I mean, and maybe it's a special team of people who will be doing like reconnaissance. I don't know. I mean, it seems awfully strange and a lot of wasted time and energy, to be honest with you.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, if I were a property owner, just like what Kevin said, I'd want to be able to do what I can. And if that means leaving two or three units vacant so that I could Airbnb them out and it makes sense, then it makes sense. I think there's other ways to go about making sure that we have enough housing versus trying to target, you know, two or three units that are unoccupied for 182 days. That's just my two cents.
Yeah. I wonder, I mean, if it's occupied short-term rental, Airbnb, is that counting?
Short-term rental. Yeah.
Maybe they can look on like AirDNA and see, oh, they were only being rented up short-term on the weekends and the rest of the time they were vacant, and they're counting against that. So
it's such a good question that Jennifer brings up, because she mentioned second homes. Those aren't going to show up on Airbnb ever. Mm-hmm. That's not the intent. So, you know, we've seen this in Summit County in Colorado. Summit County is like a touristy area, right? All the ski resorts are there. A lot of them are. So we've seen in Summit County, they have a big time affordability issue, bigger than most cities. I know it's all across the country, right? But it's bigger there. And so locals do not have places to live, but there's all of these vacant houses because they're all second homes. So they've tried to do something similar to this. And what they ended up doing was creating little communities inside the communities that you have to live there to even buy. There's a deed restriction in place to buy in those specific communities. But to say you have to rent, I just don't think that's the right, maybe not the right approach is what I'm saying, I guess. I don't know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. It hasn't worked in other areas.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Summit County. They got a lot of restrictions on Airbnb too.
They're starting to, yeah. So you have to be licensed and everything. And the licenses are just going with the owner now instead of the property. So if you sell it, you lose it.
Yep.
Yeah, but that actually makes like our Breckenridge office is dealing with that quite a bit and educating their clients and all that stuff. But that almost makes more sense than what they're trying to do here, right? Because it's like, okay, you can Airbnb it over here, you can't over here. Although that's still kind of rough, it makes a lot more sense than, you know, kind of managing or trying to track what's actually vacant or not.
Yeah, I'm not. It brings back to your point. I don't know how you would monitor that. It's the mailman?
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah. We'll see if it sticks. All right. From United States Real Estate Investor, NAR, which is National Association of Realtors, found guilty in $1.8 billion loss. Massive commissions dead. I don't know if anybody's following this.
I have been following this really heavily. Yeah.
As an agent, I'm following it.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, we could get into the weeds on this one for sure. There's multiple things in that lawsuit. There's talking about price fixing, basically, which is, in my opinion, it's a misunderstanding. And it's crazy because like who's benefiting from this is attorneys that have this kind of frivolous lawsuit. And there's some basis for where they're heading with it. But they're talking about price fixing commissions, which commissions have always been negotiable. There's kind of like a target, but it's crazy how much money has been extracted out of the industry, you know, from NAR directly, and then some other big brokerages have been named in that. And there's going to be more to come, you know, like the, there's blood in the water.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, this is kind of from the seller side. One of the things, and they have a valid point, is that the seller has paid both the listing agent's commission and the buyer agent's commission. And so they're like, hey, why are we paying that? Well, it's hard to explain, but basically that's the buyer agent commission. You got to incentivize them. So it's coming out of the purchase price in the end. If they make it so that we, like as a listing agent, can't pay a buyer's agent out of that commission that's allocated from the profit, and a buyer has to pay out of pocket their buyer agent, most buyers don't have that money, cash. And neither do a lot of sellers. Like, it's got to come out of that equity. So,
and it will. It will. There'll be, I mean, there's going to be some changes for sure.
Yeah.
But the price, I mean, I agree with you, James. I'm going to say that first. But devil's advocate, when you're the seller paying the buyer's commission, and there's a standard in the industry of 2.5 to 2.8, it's in that range, almost always 2.8. I think that's across the board. So they, I can see from a seller's perspective why they feel pressured into paying a certain amount without the ability to negotiate that. Yeah. Now,
they can negotiate. That's the thing.
They can, but they don't understand that.
That's right? True. They don't understand yet.
There's an agent in Florida. I was following this, right? And there's this agent in Florida that's freaking crazy. She doesn't want to pay. She don't want to pay a commission to whoever brings the buyer, so the buyer side agent. So she offers a $1 commission in the MLS listing.
Right.
And her thought is, well, as a fiduciary, you are responsible for presenting offers regardless of the commission, right? That's, they're supposed to do that.
Right.
Well, do you know any buyers that are actually using real estate agents to find them properties right now? I mean, that just doesn't happen. They find it on Redfin, they find it on Zillow, and they go to their agent and say, I want to look at these three houses. I mean, that's how it's working right now.
Sure.
So is the 2.8% to just let somebody into a house and represent you in a negotiation still a fair commission? I'm not here to argue one way or the other, but I can relate and understand the point here. What's probably the likely outcome is they're going to appeal, and it's going to reduce the 1.8 significantly. And then they're going to make changes, and the buyer's going to have to pay their agent. But here's how it works. So I'm going to pay, I want to pay $100,000 for this house, and I want the commission rolled in. Well, now I'm just going to offer $98,000, and I'm going to say, and you pay my commission for me as a concession. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what's going to start happening. And so it's, nothing's really going to change.
Yep.
And look, NAR, they're attacking NAR because they're the biggest lobbyist ever, like 10 times the second. You know, it's amazing how much money they put into changing rules. So I think it's more of a statement play here, but I don't see a big shift in the market. I know people are worried about it, but I don't see it.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah, to your point, it's weird when a seller is paying an agent, a buyer's agent, to negotiate against them.
It's weird.
Right? But, and kind of to the point of like paying that buyer's agent, if they're just opening doors, that is a lot of time, blah, blah, blah. But when it comes down to writing contracts, understanding contracts, explaining that to buyers, negotiating, that's the real value of having an agent on your side.
Oh, I think it's huge value. I'm not, and I don't want to say discount the value at all. And 2.8 is probably right. Okay. I'm just, my point is that I can see the price fixing argument.
Yeah.
I think agents are hugely valuable, especially on the buyer side. In fact, they should get paid more than a listing agent, because a listing agent really doesn't do anything.
Wow. Well, I don't know about that.
It's a lot of people off here.
It's a lot less brain damage and like driving around and all
this. Yeah, it's not that tough. The tough part of being an agent is finding the deals, right? That's why they need to get paid what they get paid. It's not, uploading it into the MLS.
No, that's the easy part. Anybody could do that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think being a listing agent is much more difficult now. There's a lot more than like 2 years ago. But I think what we're telling a lot of our agents is there's a couple different levels to it. It's like, one, you need to be educating both your buyer and your seller, depending on what side you're on. And then you need to make sure they need to be making sure that they're showing their value to their client and getting it in writing before you're even out looking at houses. So they know if you're charging 2.8, 3,000, 1,500, whatever your value proposition is. And then I think that very much shows what's going to happen is that it's going to be part of the negotiation, just like we've seen traditionally with closing costs and stuff like that. Buyers are not going to have this cash just come out of their pocket. It's not going to happen.
Yep. Yeah, you nailed it.
Totally agree.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how this all shakes out. Let's jump to the next one from Business Insider. Renters are getting more perks as increased construction adds to housing market supply. Let's see.
I think this is another micro argument. Okay. I'm going to deal in Kentucky, a couple hundred units, and rents have gone up and there's no concessions, no free rent, no nothing. And that's on 100% of the leases they signed in the last several months. So this obviously contradicts this article. So again, I'm thinking, you know, you're looking at it at a macro level. It's just not fair. It's not like that everywhere.
That is true. Yeah. Well, as we all say, real estate is very market-based, right?
What are you seeing, Beth, with your, you're doing multifamily stuff too, right?
Multifamily, student housing. We're pre-leasing right now for 126-bed student housing property. We are 80% pre-leased and have raised rents, no concessions, maybe a pizza party, but that's really about it. So same thing for another property that we're looking to acquire, in which we're working with the sellers right now to implement our business plan so that when we take it over, we're starting off where we want to be. But I mean, these rents are below market somewhere to the tune of $600 on average. And, you know, we started raising them at least, you know, $200 to $300, no concessions, and people are paying it. So, again, I think it is market specific. So, you know, where some of these articles come from and information and so forth is not necessarily, the big picture.
Yeah, it mentions Phoenix and Atlanta. There's a boom in multifamily developments there, so mm-hmm. It's starting to get hit there.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. And I'm not sure on multifamily here in Denver, but as you guys that live here know, this has been a city of cranes, like just building. There's got to be a shift, you know? Mm-hmm. We'll see. Let's see. Anybody else have comments on that? I did make a comment here to myself. Home sellers are starting to do concessions here and then Denver for sure. Mm-hmm. I've had a few listings recently and I'm watching what these other listings are doing, and they're overpricing constantly for different reasons, you know, like the sellers think their property's worth way more. The market's shifted. And then you have agents going, we think that we're going to get that for you too. And listing way too high. And then they sit on the market longer. And then they have to do price reductions. So like I'm selling a condo for a friend right now. We're not listed yet, but I've been watching all the other units. They're all just sitting there. And it's a seasonal thing too, right? I mean, we're in the worst time to be selling, but they're all overpriced and they're just sitting in price drops here and there. So.
Yeah, I don't know that I would agree it's the worst time to be selling. I think that, obviously there's seasonality in transactions. Yep. But there's also seasonality in inventory. So I think anytime's a good time to sell. And if you're seeing that, James, I would list now. Like come in under them before they start dropping their prices. So you're gone first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh yeah. I was trying to to get my seller to consider selling even without doing some remodel stuff. Like, let's do it before we're right in the middle of Christmas, New Year's, winter, you know. But we're going to be...
People buy houses, people buy condos in every month.
Yep. Yep. This complex, the HOA is like $700.
Oh, jeez. Where's that?
That's a painful one. It's out off like Parker and Quebec.
Must be a nice swimming pool, huh?
They do get a lot. They got a nice swimming pool, hot tub, pickleball courts, nice open area storage, underground parking, all that. So they are getting something for it. So, yeah. Well, hey, let's jump to the next one from Fox Business. A housing market price drop only seen a handful of times is coming in 2024, Morgan Stanley says. They're thinking there might be a 3% drop in home prices, according to the article, which they haven't seen in 35 years.
They obviously forgot about 2008.
Yeah, I'm like, where'd that come from? Where's Morgan Stanley getting their data? What are they looking at?
Doesn't make any sense.
Well,
I think it was 14% this recession. Now, I know we haven't officially hit the recession yet because jobs are so strong, so I get it. But we were in a recession. I mean, we learned in school 2/4 of GDP, negative GDP, that's a recession, right? We hit that. The inverted yield curve, we hit that. So for it to not be called a recession seems silly to me. And we had a 14% drop in real estate values. Now we've gained back most of that. Where is this coming from?
Yeah. I'm like, Morgan Stanley, how does it benefit them to like throw that little bit of news out there to like manipulate a market, right?
Clickbait?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So, I mean, what do you guys think about the housing market? I mean, we still have an inventory crisis, right? I mean, we're close to a record low, like ever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
And then as we talked about the seasonality, as we sink more into the winter, I think we might actually hit a record. So how do you see a crash coming that we haven't seen in 35 years when there's nothing to buy? You know, it's supply and demand. It's pure, the fundamentals of economics, supply, demand. We have no supply. What does that do? That increases value. Mm-hmm. It's very simple.
Yeah. Beth, did you have something?
No, I just was shaking my head. Yes. I mean, I don't play in the like single family home space as much as I used to when I was fixing and flipping, but occasionally I'll hop on Zillow to see what's available, and it's pretty scarce, you know, in and around where we're at. And I'm in Cincinnati, pretty conservative market. And our prices are still, they're still skyrocketing. So they're still going up, and I don't see that really stopping anytime soon.
Yeah.
Well, and all the experts are predicting, maybe not Morgan Stanley, take that out. All the experts are predicting interest rates declining in 2024.
Right.
I mean, they've adjusted their projections up, so I get that, but it's still lower than what we are right now. So how is declining interest rates, I mean, gosh, it just doesn't make any sense. Declining interest rates generally boosts real estate values. So we might see, you might see more value increase. Or did they say, like, I'm trying to read this, did they say a specific market they're targeting, or is this just in general? Here's what it's a conspiracy, you guys. You know what they want? They want you to sell your real estate now before it crashes 3% and invest it in Morgan Stanley.
Yeah. There we go.
There you go.
Uh-huh. It's a fight. All right. Let's jump to our fun news item from CNBC. Make it. Successful people have more productive paranoia than most, says best-selling author Jim Collins. Here's how to cultivate it. So I guess the concept involves anticipating and preparing for every possible outcome of decisions, both in careers and personal lives. Straight quote. Anybody have any, did you guys read this or?
I know, I, in fact, I'm like productive paranoia, you might have to define that for, I didn't know what that is. But it basically just means being prepared, that's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, just preparing for the worst. Acquiring new skills, like AI expertise right. was one of the things that they talked about.
Here's, it's funny, I like Jim Collins, so I'm gonna be careful here. It's like saying, like, duh, are you serious? Successful people have this more than others? That's like spending money doesn't create inflation. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. So, I mean, but I like Jim Collins, so I'm gonna, I'll be careful here because the rest of it says, here's how you cultivate it. So maybe that's what the article's about. But yes, of course, if you have productive paranoia, you're gonna be more successful than somebody who doesn't. Yes. Yep.
Yeah, I think it's a fair statement. I know of a very, very successful multifamily operator. And, you know, one of the things that he talks about at great length is how he looks at a situation and he will work backwards. In other words, he looks at it from the most negative standpoint, like what is the worst case scenario that could happen with this deal, and then works backwards in terms of how he is going to approach it so that he's completely prepared. And I don't know that everybody operates that way. I don't know that everybody looks at, okay, what's my worst case scenario? And I'm going to, you know, plan for that. And then, you know, also look at all of these other scenarios in between. I think, you know, sometimes people go into situations and, you know, with rose colored glasses on thinking that, oh, this is going to happen and here's how it's going to go down. And voila. I mean, I had my share of failures and fix and flips in which I had rose colored glasses on thinking that, oh yeah, we're going to sell for this. And instead of maybe preparing for, hey, what if we don't get this, you know, here's my margin, or maybe I need to turn this into a rental. So maybe that's just where he's going with it is that there are people who experience greater success because they plan, for the worst and then work backwards from there.
Yeah, I love it. I love where you're going with that. It makes me think, Beth, when I was listening to you, it made me think about the real estate industry. And since 2010, let's call it that, to today, so 22, 23 years, it's been a pretty good ride. I mean, you could be a terrible real estate investor and do pretty well. In fact, there's an argument to be made. The worse of an investor you are, and the longer it takes you to get through your projects, the more money you made. So I think now, as the market's starting to shift, we're going to start seeing those not as skilled or experienced investors not do as well because the market's not going to bail them out. There's no market given gains here. You have to earn your gains now.
True, true. Well, hey, guys, that's our show for this month. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Jason Palliser's 2-Day Investment Blueprint, and REI Content Packs. Again, thanks to our guests, Jennifer Statz, Kevin Amosh, and Beth Underhill. In that order, why don't you guys let people know how they can connect with you, if you want them connect with you.
It's usually the easiest to get a hold of me, either going to statsolutions.com, or it's pretty easy to find me on Instagram. My Instagram is Jennifer the Realtor.
Awesome. So two real quick here, James, we talked a lot about the economy today, of course, because we're talking about headlines and I get some feedback often about, are we going to see a crash like we saw in the credit crunch? Is it going to be anything like that? So what I did was I looked back over the last recessions to try to find one that's similar to what we're seeing today. And it's the 1990s, early 90s. So we were just coming out of the savings and loan. And if you remember in the 80s, after the war, we had in the 80s, we had the savings and loan crisis, right? So the banking pressure and the high inflation and high interest rates. These are double digit interest rates. So that 1990 single family home correction is very similar to what we're seeing right now. So I wrote a report comparing those two to try to help investors. So you can contact me or get that report at thepinereport.com. Otherwise, I would say pinefinancialgroup.com is the best way to reach me.
Cool. Oh, also, you have a book that just came out too.
My
right?
second book we just published, and it went to number one. James, I don't know if you knew that. So we got to number one in all of real estate in Amazon. So I was super proud of that release. So the fundyourflip.com, fundyourflip.com will take you to that.
Awesome. Congrats. That's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
Cool. Awesome. Beth?
Sure. So easiest way to find me at Investing with Beth. You can find me on Instagram and TikTok there. You can also shoot me a text or call me 513-470-1078. I give that out only because I love to text and it's just the quickest way to get in touch.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for being on, guys. Again, I'm your host, James Brown. Show people how to make safe double-digit returns through our hybrid investing model. Go to hybridinvestor.vip to learn more. Also, a huge thanks to a big cheese in the background, Antonio Holman with United States Real Estate Investor. Follow and subscribe to This Month in Real Estate Investing on YouTube at youtube.com/@UnitedStatesREI or your favorite podcast app. And if you run across any interesting news, events, or good guest suggestions, feel free to share by emailing Antonio@UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com. And remember, when one door closes, another door opens to financial freedom. Take care.